Hello, and welcome to The Literary City, episode 74. Now, some poetry is easy to understand, just as some art is easy to understand, like art that is realistic, as opposed to art that is abstract, like modern art, where the abstraction on the canvas is not something that you must only view, but rather something that you must feel. Now, almost all of us can tell random jabs of paint from what constitutes modern art. Poetry is something like that. It seems easy to get into, and almost everyone does. But like modern or abstract art, it is hard to figure out what is its measure of skill, and against what benchmark do you judge an effort in poetry? Now, in whatever form poetry presents itself, whether abstract verse or rap, fellow poets will either appreciate it or look down their noses at it. And how do they do this? By some kind of inner measure of its skill that they recognize. But indeed, we all do immediately recognize skill when we see it. And my guest today is an example of skill that you can recognize. He is Abe Kay, a poet and a diplomat, and is currently the Deputy Director of the Indian Council for Cultural Relations in New Delhi. One night, a few years ago, when Abe was the Indian Ambassador to Madagascar, the stars of the skies in the Southern Hemisphere inspired him to write a line of poetry. And before long, he had compiled a most wonderful book of rhyming couplets on the galaxy. The book is called Celestial, and the book itself is a wondrous piece of art with illustrations by the renowned 10th century Persian astronomer Abd al-Rahman al-Sufi, known in the West as Azofi. Celestial is only 100 rhyming couplets, but indeed, it tells the story of 88 constellations in our galaxy. Reading Celestial drove me from one rabbit hole into another, and I lost myself for many hours in trying to discover constellations in the galaxy and what they meant and what their names mean. And then the illustrations by Abd al-Rahman al-Sufi drove me into Ptolemy, and I can tell you that I spent days just over 100 rhyming couplets. That, to me, is the measure of skill in poetry. Abe is a returning guest, and I'm eager to have him back. So here he is joining me from New Delhi. Abe, welcome back to the Literary City.
Thank you, Ramji. It's such a pleasure to be back again with you, your fabulous podcast, The Literary City. So honored to make it back, I would say.
Oh, goodness. That's kind of you. The honor is mine. But to plunge in directly, Abe, I have a question. Are all poets stargazers?
Are poets stargazers? Yes, I would say that, because poets try to see more than what usually people see. And stars are, of course, one of them. They look at the sky more often than most of the people do. I mean, like, as it is said, that stars are our friends, our guides, and they provide us with fascination, wonder, and curiosity. So that's why I guess poets, you know, they look more towards the sky and often end up watching the stars.
So are you saying that you can't refer to the stars without that invoking some kind of emotion?
And poetry, yes, that's true, actually. What I felt very striking, at night you can look at the stars every day, but we can't see the other city, but we can see stars, you know. And we can reach to them, you know. So see, look at the irony here. The stars, which are light billion years away, we can see the light coming from them, while we can't see, you know, our neighbor next door, you know. So that's something I thought, stars as friends, as someone very intimate, someone you can talk to.
Who I can't talk to is my utility company that takes longer to send me light than some stars that have died in some distant galaxy.
Their light's reaching up.
But speaking of man's interest in stars, there are two branches of this that have intrigued me for a long time. One scientific, which is astronomy, and the other decidedly unscientific, that's astrology. And I've always been interested in this connection, however tenuous, between poetry and various disciplines that are complicated or difficult to understand. In this case, the junction of poetry, science, and art. Isn't Sufi's illustrations based on Ptolemy's Almagest, isn't that an example?
Well, see, this book, The Book of Fixed Stars by Al-Rahman al-Sufi, it's a good example of cross-section of astronomy and art. It's actually not a book of art. You know, the Book of Fixed Stars is a book of science, actually. This, what was missing from the Almagest of Ptolemy was these illustrations. And Al-Rahman al-Sufi, he brought illustrations to this book, and that's what made the book popular. And that's what has survived today in popular imagination. So it's so important that we bring these together, I'll give you another example. If you look at the word universe itself, it's, if you break it, it's actually uni and verse, and it means one verse.
That's an interesting take.
And I see quarks, building blocks of atoms as poets and playing with the word universe, quark of a poet blossoming in the subatomic space. In one way, we can look at quarks as poets.
Well, I know this is an obvious thing to say, but that was poetic. And I've never thought of poets as quarks. The word that comes to my mind has always been quirks.
Very well put.
I'd like to move on now to discussing the book Celestial, which is why we're here today. I did describe the book in my monologue, but if you could reduce a description of that book to maybe a sentence, what would you say the book is about?
An epic journey, an epic journey through 88 star constellations in search of the beloved through the universe. That's the description of the book.
Simple and direct as you make it. It's the book is only 100 rhyming couplets. Couplets is two lines, so which means the entire book is 200 lines. Yet, every time I read a couplet and read the name of the constellation, I spent all my time Googling it.
So there's more work outside the book, The book is only kind of a hint. And you explore on your own,
Yeah, I know. You start to read the book and a couple of hours later, where did all the time go? Now, when you started to write Celestial, you were the Indian ambassador to Madagascar, and you explained in the foreword that you spent a night looking at the stars, or you looked up at the stars, and it came to you. I'll let you tell it. What was the sentiment when you first saw those stars, and how did they speak to you?
Right. Well, so one night I woke up at around 2 a.m. and I saw the constellation of Scorpius kind of outside the window. It was like so bright because the sky is very clear there. So you can see stars as they are like next door neighbors. I felt this line coming, awake each night, I savor starlight. And this was the feeling, which was very ethereal, which was very divine, which was very cosmic. That's how life is. Long time ago, in my first book, I had written a poem in which I had used the word on a path lit by a jillion stars. So that kind of thing, when you see like cosmos all around you, you are like traveling through the universe. So that was the feeling. And I used to see the stars like that in my childhood from my home. At night, we used to sleep on the rooftop or in the courtyard and in the open sky, and you could see the stars above you. Now, all that is gone. But that I felt again after years in Madagascar, the same feeling came, the childhood memory of gazing at the stars. And I felt that, oh, wow, awake each night, I savor starlight.
So what did you do when you had that inspiration? Clearly you didn't roll over and go back to sleep and forget the next morning.
So I thought now, this is such a beautiful line. So can I expand on it. And then I thought of a plot where I can travel to all the star constellations.
Mm-hmm.
And the second line, which was to expand the plot. And the plot was someone on Earth is looking for his or her beloved in the stars, who is playing a game of hide and seek from one constellation to another. Like, it's like constellation hopping. And I had read, when I was in college, I had read a poem by Lord Alfred Tennyson called Locksley Hall. And Locksley Hall was a visionary poem. And I had never read the whole poem. But in Madagascar, I got the opportunity to read the whole poem, which also had mentioned the constellation of Orion. And I thought that, oh, wow, I mean, should I like do a poem? So I do the maths and saw that there are 88 constellations. And if I can write a poem of 100 rhyming verses, rhyming couplets, I could probably have a poem like Locksley Hall, you know.
How interesting.
Yes. So that was then the inspiration. And I thought, how to extend the couplets. So I thought of this plot of someone on Earth is looking for one's beloved in the stars. And love, you know, is an eternal theme for humanity. Emotions, you know, it's a theme which will live as long as humanity lives, you know. So that's something very basic with us, with our species or any other species, you know, we feel love. I mean, I try to bring in this theme of love and search for beloved.
And there are some really evocative couplets in there. Now, these 88 constellations that you have covered, now these are the constellations recognized by the International Astronomical Union, right? And now, from the science to the art. Now, the art is a significant part of your book. And these are the illustrations by Abdul Rahman, a Sufi, in his book of fixed stars, am I right?
Yeah.
Now, his book, principally, was to illustrate the work of Ptolemy and Almagest, right?
Right, Almagest, yeah.
So he took a book of science, astronomy, and did illustrations to them and turned it into a story, a pictorial story.
Right, he not only worked, I mean, his base was Almagest, but he also improved upon Ptolemy's work, actually. So he added lots of new stars, he put more accurate measurements, and did lots of improvements to Almagest. Also made the work popular in the Arab world because the book was in Arabic. He was a Persian, but he wrote in Arabic, old Arabic.
Right. And for the cover, you chose his illustration of, what's this, Sagittarius.
Yes, you can see that. And Sagittarius also looks like a bit like, you know, the god of love, you know.
Oh, yeah, Cupid.
Cupid, because he has the arrow. So that's why, you know, like if you read the poem about, which goes with Sagittarius, it says, I gaze at the wise archer Sagittarius, how his love arrows have not spared us.
And that does keep to the theme of the book. Now, southern hemisphere skies over Madagascar. Yes. For us residents of the northern hemisphere, we're always intrigued about the skies in the south and about the southern hemisphere in general. And the first thing we want to know is, when you flush the toilet, does the water go in the opposite direction? And in fact, I was quite fascinated to know that there are some constellations that can only be seen in the southern hemisphere, not in the northern hemisphere, and the other way around.
Yeah, so that's why the original number of constellations which Ptolemy in Almagest he records is only 48.
That's true.
Next 40 were added between 15th to 18th century because, you know, explorers started traveling to those areas and they saw these new constellations and that's how they added.
Another thing that I discovered while researching this podcast was the existence of this organization, Dark Sky International.
Yes.
And they have a list of places that are dark sky without light pollution. You can see the stars.
So important, no? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Like, the sky we had at grandma's place has gone. I mean, there's so much of light now, you can't see them.
Yeah, it's true.
So also the light pollution, it also disturbs the other species, their sleeping patterns, their reproduction, etc.
To get a list of dark sky places, go to darksky.org or darksky.org, and they have such a list of places. So surprisingly, some of them could be right next door to you. Our regular listenership is from over 90 countries, so lots of dark sky places in that list. And now to move on from what we were talking about, which is poetry at the junction of science and art, I'd like to go to something else that I mentioned in the monologue, which is, what is the measure of skill in poetry? You know, poetry has very low entry barriers. I dare say much the same as podcasts.
And poetry is another.
And poetry is another. Modern art also. So when I was asking around, what is the measure of skill in poetry? Someone turned around and said, what do you think it is? And to answer the question, honestly, I can only boil it down to saying that a poem is a good poem if it triggers something in me or in someone else. Other than all the technical aspects, it has to contribute to some sense of feeling at a visceral level. Your view?
Yeah, see, so of course there are different levels of poetry, you know. They are equally entitled, each one of these are equally entitled to be called poetry. You know? For example, you have the poetry behind the trucks, you know, like written.
Yeah.
That's also, I mean, it's about, you know, sentiments, about, because poetry is about feelings.
Right.
And feelings have to be there to call something a poem. So that's also poetry. But also we have Instagram poets, like you have all these four lines, five lines, very striking lines. So these are Instagram poets. That's also poetry. So there are different levels or different kinds of poetry. What Guljar writes is also poetry. I mean, clear lyrics, but also poetry, right? I mean, there are levels, you know, there are different levels. But you can see the skills, you know, you can feel it. I mean, I have been writing poetry now over a decade and a half. I mean, I see that the poems I used to write, my first book, for example, and now they're quite different. If I look at the first book, I want to edit those words.
Don't be all then.
So yeah, so that's how you know that you have progressed.
Yes, as you grow older, your frame of reference is broader, and you're just more mature.
Right. And also the choice of words and use of poetic, like poetry also uses the metaphors and figures of speech, you know, alliterations.
Right.
There's so many of them. And there's so many poetry schools. You have different kind of poems. You have sonnets, you have villanelles, you have couplets. This couplet in Hindi, it's called Doha. And I was reading, the Doha actually originated in Nalanda by the Apabhransa poets. Then it became a form which was pretty popular, and Kabir and later poets used them. But these were mainly evolved by Siddha poets from Nalanda University.
Right. I mean, they were very interesting,
very active during 8th to 13th century. But it takes a whole lifetime of practice to master the skills, and it's like a tapasya, it's like a, you know, penance.
Penance. Everyone thinks they can write poetry. My problem is that everyone does. You made the point that poetry is subjective,
right,
and that poetry should trigger something.
Right.
Does poetry trigger something in you when you write it? Mm-hmm.
Of course. I mean, see, it's when you're writing, you don't know how is it going to shape up. If you know, then it's not really very good poetry. So poems lead you. You don't lead the poem, right?
Right. But poetry has led you to a rather prodigious output. You have published so much in so little time. Mm-hmm. Your books of poetry have involved coordinating poets from all over the world. And on top of everything else, you hold down a very important job. So the obvious question, how do you do it?
So it's, for me, both kind of complement each other. For example, I mostly write about the places I have been to, like, for example, the alphabets of Latin America. So I'm doing both the things every day. I have somehow merged the two into one. There have been many, many more who have been more more productive, more have written more and published more than me. And I can't even imagine if I can do that. Like, give you an example of Pablo Neruda, wrote lots of work which are now immortal lines. Octavio Paz, for example, from Mexico. George Seferis from Greece. St. John Persay from France. Gabriela Mistral from Chile. So many of them who are great inspirations to me. And I mean, if I can match even 1% of them, you know, what have they done?
Not coincidentally, many of the names you've mentioned were also diplomats.
Yes, they are poets and diplomats. Yes, they have done great work in both poetry and diplomacy. Each one of them were ambassadors. Like Octavio Paz was Mexico's ambassador to India. Neruda was Chile's ambassador to France.
Well, we covered many of these in our last podcast.
Yeah, a discussion.
Yeah, that's true. Well, anyway, now, before I let you go, I'm sure that you have a lot of unpublished work in that satchel bag of yours. So what's next?
I'm working on a book on Nalanda, which is my next book.
Wow.
And I also have a book on Africa, In Light of Africa, which takes you across Africa through its dance and music and cuisine and, you know, personalities and so many other various facets of Africa and its contributions in shaping modernity in our world. So also India, Africa connections through Malik Ambar and so many others. And I look forward to, you know, these books in the coming years.
As do I. And on that note, it was great fun. Thank you so much for being my guest on The Literary City a second time.
Thank you for having me the second time. This is an absolute pleasure and honor, and I look forward to listening to this.
You've been listening to Abe K, a diplomat, a poet, and the author of Celestial. Now, while there's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy the book, remember to support your local bookstore. And by the way, Celestial makes an excellent gift. And I'll be back with What's That Word? A segment where we usually look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. Etymology, in other words. But today, we have a wonderful addition to the show, and that is Karthik Venkatesh, an editor at Penguin and the author of a fascinating book, 10 Indian Languages and How They Came to Be, right after this. Hello, I'm back. This is What's That Word? And she, my co-host.
Hello, my name is Praniti, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello to you, P with an A. Are you excited?
About what?
In general.
Always. Absolutely I am.
No, I'm kidding. Well, I'm asking you about how differently we will do What's That Word today.
That I'm very excited about. So this week, instead of a book or a phrase, we have an entire book and an entire author.
Yes, Karthik Venkatesh. In whole, not in parts.
But before we go to Karthik, let me say that interview with Abhay was so entertaining.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. But what exactly, though?
I'm happy that you had that discussion with him about what is the measure of skill in poetry when everyone is a poet.
Thanks. Yes, true. Abhay does know his art and his craft.
As does our next guest today.
That's right.
So will you introduce him and his book now? And then let's get him on the show.
Sure. Here goes. My next guest today is an executive editor of Penguin and the author of a wonderful book, 10 Indian Languages and How They Came to Be. Now, the title of this book belies its content. It looks like a slim volume, and the title does resemble another listicle.
Listicles? Ugh.
Yes, the scourge of literary prose.
Yes.
And an opportunity for unfortunate rhyme. But the resemblance stops there. The book is less than 150 pages, about 135 pages. But in reality, each page feels like a chapter, and every paragraph a section within it. Now, 10 Indian Languages is packed with information, and it is obviously a result of considerable research. But there are two things that strike me from reading the book. One, that the research is not something put together for the book, but supplemental to the years of knowledge that the author, Karthik Venkatesh has gained, either by pursuing knowledge, or simply by observation, or even by osmosis. Two, that it was possible for Karthik to have condensed so much knowledge into so few pages, principally, I think, because he is, by profession, an editor. And this is what editors do, right?
Yeah, usually to others.
I reckon. But he did this to himself.
Yeah, and very well too, I might add.
So there it is, a book about Indian languages, many of them little known, some of them dying with the last of their speakers, and some born as a patois from the increasing syncretic and, you know, multilingualistic landscape of modern urban India. And that is as condensed an introduction to the author as I could have managed.
And with that, we're delighted to welcome him to the show. Karthik Venkatesh, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you. Great to be here. Looking forward to it.
So, Karthik, to kick things off, I wanted to start with a general question. Now, your book covers so much, you know, like Ramji said in his intro. How much time went into the research of this book?
The writing of this book took about a year, little less. But yeah, the reading for the book, about 18 months or so before I started actually doing the writing. So yeah, about two and a half years.
Only 18 months to research that much?
Yeah.
There's a lot in that book.
Yeah, I mean, I'd researched, and I think I kind of I had a handle on, say, a language. Mm-hmm. And in the writing of it, I'd realized that, you know, there was so much more that I needed to know. So I just put things away and then go back to my research.
Any part that was a challenge?
Getting the intro right, I wrote several drafts of it. Mm-hmm. Took a while longer.
Well, it wasn't only your challenge, because the big challenge for us right now is what to ask you. We could be here till tomorrow asking you questions.
Page. Oh, wow. There isn't that much. It's only 30,000 words, the book.
Kind of the kick and the bite of it is more like 200,000 words or thereabouts.
How nice to hear that.
I'll tell you why. And in fact, very specifically, one of our earlier guests on this podcast was Professor Ganesh Devi,
right?
You know, who authored PLSI, People's Linguistic Survey of India. Judging by everything that I know about that, your task was no less complex.
Ganesh Devi was a very important resource, especially in terms of the questions that he asked, which he chose to answer and try and answer through the People's Linguistic Survey of India. His whole outlook about what is lost when a language loses speakers. I think those kind of perspectives are very, very important to thinking about languages in general, thinking about why they are important, thinking about how you can kind of delve into their history and their background and so on.
Jumping to another significant part of your book, you talked about the creation of Indian states by language parameters. And you did mention that there was a certain amount of initial hesitancy about it because they were scared of divides.
Right.
But they went ahead with it. So in your reckoning, how's that working out for us?
I'd say it's actually worked out quite fine.
You think so?
I think so. By and large, I think it's largely worked out fine. I think the hesitation was largely, we'd come through this horrendous partition. And the worry was that dividing people into linguistic states would create, you know, the groundwork for more partitions. That was the fear. That was the underlying fear. But then the Congress had promised this kind of reorganization of Indian states. They'd been talking about it for years before partition, at least two decades before partition. So the thing is, people had already this vision that, you know, in the independent India that they were going to be part of, you know, each language would kind of get its own state.
I agree with you. I think that that's a first point of belonging and sentiment is one's own language. For instance, the languages of the South that are Dravidian in origin. P, you had a question about that, about the age of the Dravidian languages, which especially makes sense in the context of this discussion. So please go ahead with your question.
I was curious about the age of Dravidian languages. You know, the proto-Dravidian languages date back to 1500 BCE. How do they know it's that old?
So, see, what they do is there is this discipline of philology, which is comparative linguistics. They look at languages and their words and their vocabulary and so on. And they try to figure out which word comes from where, which word is perhaps original to a language, which word has been borrowed from other languages. And there is some evidence of Dravidian words in the Rig Veda itself. Some words have been found that are very likely of Dravidian origin. And that's how they kind of seem to sense or seem to have figured out that Dravidian languages, a Dravidian language, maybe more than one, was in existence even around the time of the Rig Veda. And then there's the enduring mystery of what language did the Indus Valley civilization speak.
Right.
And more than one scholar has kind of said that it was probably a Dravidian language. There is no evidence of it, but there's no clear evidence of it, let's say, because the script hasn't yet been deciphered. But by and large, there seems to be this consensus that it probably was one, and eventually perhaps some evidence will be found. And it also therefore fits in with the Vedic civilization that came after and the few words of Dravidian origin that have been found in the Rig Veda and the subsequent Veda.
But speaking of philology and linguistics and the simple matter of recording languages, the very first effort made to record and keep a track of all Indian languages was by Grierson, wasn't it?
Right.
And so tell us a little bit more about Grierson and his linguistic survey of India. That was a pioneering work, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the British loved classifying, kind of clearly surveying them. And so the whole business of surveying had begun, in the early 19th century itself. So several surveys were conducted over the course of the 19th century. Archaeological, zoological, botanical, geological, trigonometrical. All of these surveys, they served certain very specific purposes for the British in terms of administration, revenue, and so on. But they also served the purpose of, amassing knowledge about India. The linguistic survey was actually pretty much the last one. And that's interesting. They came to the languages much, much later. And Grierson was a civil servant, an ICS officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it upon himself to kind of do this. He began his work in the early 1890s. The last volume of the linguistic survey was published in 1928. The first volume was published in 1903. So with a monumental effort, everywhere. And as the technology changed, Grierson's methods also changed. Initially, he had these surveyors go out, collect language samples or specimens, as he called them.
Right.
And later, he actually started recording people speaking in the various languages, and those recordings still exist.
Huh.
So we have a great wealth of material. And he pretty much surveyed all of India, barring, I think, a few parts of South India where he couldn't get permission to enter.
Now, speaking of the British people's contributions to classifying and recording languages, there are quite a few names in your book. Started fairly early, for instance, East India Company's time, 1798, you wrote about a Charles Philip Lewis?
Charles Philip Brown.
Brown.
Brown. C.P. Brown.
C.P. Brown. He did Telugu, correct?
Yeah.
By the way, he lived a long life, didn't he?
86.
Unusual for his time.
Yeah.
And then you had Benjamin Lewis Rice in Bangalore, Kannada.
Absolutely.
And who else do you mention? Let's see. Christian Larsen, Brahmi.
Who began deciphering.
Right, didn't do the whole thing himself.
Yeah, he did actually very little.
Oh.
James Prinsep did much of it.
James Prinsep, the winner of the Feroz Shah Award.
Well, Feroz Shah was dead and gone. But Feroz Shah had originally announced an award, for deciphering what was written.
Yeah, I know. We're talking about 1354 when he offered an award for the deciphering of the Ashoka inscriptions.
Yeah.
And then Gilchrist codified education in Hindi.
Right.
And of course, famously, Monroe, who insisted that all Indian civil service officers learn the language of the region in which they are posted.
Required to learn the language of their cadre state.
Right. So all in all, if it wasn't for the Brits, huh?
You really think so?
you tell me. You wrote the book.
Well, the Brits clearly played a huge role in classifying it, figuring things out, you know, collecting it.
Yeah, they were good at record keeping, right?
Absolutely. They were terrific.
Yeah, I guess that our tradition of passing on information, education, was oral.
Yeah.
Oral histories and so on. Yeah. P, you mentioned that you were fascinated by a Dravidian language that was spoken in Pakistan. And you asked me too many questions about this. Here's the author. Ask him.
Yeah, thanks. So, Karthik, this is about Brahui. Am I saying it right?
Brahui, yeah.
Yeah. So this, like Ramji said, is spoken in Pakistan. But how does it make it Dravidian then?
So the way the language is, the grammar, the sentence formation, structure of the language is very clearly Dravidian. There are several Dravidian words in the language. In the process of studying languages in the 19th century, I think they realized this was obviously a language allied with the Dravidian language of South India.
Right.
It was what we call a language isolate, you know, which is very different from the other languages around it, is found in a certain geography. And there are many examples of language isolates, but Brahui is perhaps one of the most interesting ones in the subcontinent.
Hey, were you asking how Dravidian is this language actually?
Yeah.
Well, there's a video on YouTube of a guy, a Brahui speaker, who has got a Tamil guy, and they're both sitting in his bedroom on the bed, and they're trading notes on each other's language. And the resemblance is amazing.
Wow.
We'll put a link in the podcast description to that video.
It is. And there's a list of words even in the book, you know, words that are in Brahui that are very common to Dravidian languages.
Karthik, speaking of, it's in your book. Reading your book, every time I had a question, I turned the page and there was the answer. You make it hard for interviewers. It's totally packed, and that's what the book is like. It's rich with information. And cycling back to another oddity, you know, language cannot exist without the politicization of it. And in South India, for instance, there's a lot of resentment and opposition to the notion that Hindi should be imposed on them. But what came as a surprise to me, that in Pakistan, there's a move and there's a sentiment against Urdu imposition. I didn't know it, didn't think of it.
Yeah, that is one of perhaps the lesser known stories of the Indian subcontinent. Urdu imposition is resented deeply by many Pakistanis, you know, especially Sindhis, Baloches, Pashtuns, etc., who have very strong and proud linguistic traditions themselves. Because actually, if you see, Urdu is from India, and it's the migrants who went to Pakistan who took Urdu there. Urdu is not native to Pakistan.
And Urdu is often referred to as a camp language. But Urdu means camp, doesn't it?
Yeah. Originally, yes. That's where it developed, in the camps.
Trade routes?
Trade routes, coming together of all kinds of people who developed this lingua franca to communicate among themselves, you know, or many beautiful things.
And some not so beautiful, I understand. Like everything else, Urdu also has its hierarchies, isn't it? There's the snobbery of better Urdu.
like every other language, I think there are groups who claim to be speaking a better form of Urdu.
I guess every language has its Henry Higgins.
Yeah, which is actually a funny thing, because no language is pure.
Right.
Languages grow, they adopt alien words, phrases, which don't seem so alien anymore after, you know, a few decades or a couple of hundred years.
Right. Moving on through your book, there's a wonderful chapter on Brahmi. And unfortunately, we don't have the time, because those questions will take a long time. But towards the end of the book, there is a more popularist, if you like, chapter on Hinglish.
Yeah. Speaking of how languages are not pure and how one delves into the other and words are just adopted. Hinglish, you know, that's a variant language. But are there other variants, like Sanketi, and, you know, in Pondicherry, they speak a combination of French and Tamil.
Yeah. This kind of hybrid language is pretty common. Sanketi is Tamil and Kannada.
Yeah, I speak Tamil and Kannada, but I can barely understand Sanketi.
Because when, I think when you put it in a mixer, when you blend them together, you're not sure how it's being blended.
I like the blender analogy.
Yeah.
Not always the same blade. Huh?
And there's a wonderful instance of Nagamese, which is a mix of Naga languages and Assamese, with a few words in Hindi and Bengali thrown in.
So many of those. But before you go, P had a question for you.
Yeah, so you classify this book, which is so rich with so much information, and clearly you've done so much research to bring out this book. Why is it classified as a children's book?
That is a good question.
Let's just say the editor who approached me to write it is a children's book editor. And through discussions with her, Shayani Basu, this book came to light and we put it under children's books.
But for our listeners, I want to make the case that children should read it, adults should read it. Indeed, I did. And I didn't think about this children's book thing.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Same. What next? Will there be another book?
Well, I have a couple of ideas and I was wondering whether I could kind of broaden the horizon of this book itself.
Good plan.
Try and broaden it to some more languages, perhaps all of India's 22 scheduled languages and then some. So that's the thought that I am with at the moment.
You're looking at me, P. More questions? I have a lot of questions. I have questions all the way till tomorrow afternoon. But we don't have the time, sadly.
On that note, Karthik Venkatesh, thank you so much for being our guest on The Literary City.
Thank you. Thank you. It was great talking to both of you.
You have been listening to Karthik Venkatesh, the author of 10 Indian Languages and How They Came to Be. Now, that is another book that will make great reading and a great gift. And there's a link in the podcast description where you can buy yourself a copy of that book, or better, visit your local bookstore.
Wow, that was so much fun.
Wasn't it?
And you guys are doing a live session in a local bookstore later this month.
Yes, we are. Those are fun, you know, as you've been to all of them, sometimes unpredictable.
Yeah, before we do, I simply must squeeze in something of etymology.
Oh, sure. Go ahead, P with an A. What's that word?
You said patwa.
Ah, yes. And let me tell you, this word is for all doggies.
Doggies? I love this word already.
As do I. All right, very quickly. Patwa means a provincial dialect. It was referred to somewhat dismissively to indicate uneducated working class people in France. But that was in the 17th century. The origins are said to be from the 13th century, probably from the early word for paw, which was pate, and then from the Gallo-Roman word pata, which etymologists liken to clumsiness, you know, such as a young dog with huge paws, you know, slamming you all over the place. So the association was similar to paw at a language, like a clumsy little doggy might paw at you.
Aw, but how interesting this is.
Patwa, I know. I wish I could delve into it more, and I have so much information, but we just don't have the time.
We don't. Like you told Ramchandra Guha in our last episode, we have an egg timer.
Yes, we do, don't we?
And as for clumsy pawing, I only wish it was restricted to dogs.
Which dogs?
Not the humankind.
That's funny.
New etymology to hit my pals with tonight. And speaking of egg timers, bye.
And that's our show. I'd like to thank my guests, Abhay K and Karthik Venkatesh, and my co-host, Pranathi, P with an A, Madhav. And all of you for being here and for listening, and in advance, for hitting that subscribe button and the like button and every other button that makes us look good. Until we meet again, have a wonderful time. I am Ramji Chandran, and this is The Literary City.